Welcome to Our Story, Your Story, the video podcast where we share our personal experiences and invite you to share yours. We are Toby Eunice and Shelley Carney, and together we'll take you on a journey through our lives and the lives of our family, friends, and guests. We believe that everyone has a story to tell, and we can all learn from each other's experiences. So whether you're looking for inspiration, entertainment, or simply a good story, you've come to the right place. Hello, and welcome to Our Story, Your Story. I'm Shelley Carney.
And I'm Toby Eunice. Thanks for joining us.
Today, we're going to be diving into A Gypsy's Kiss, A Treasure Hunt Adventure, Chapter 22, which is entitled The Boltons. And if you remember from last time, Miguel was rescued by Ranger Bolton when a bear was after his dinner, and she fed his fish to her cubs and then tried to chase him up a tree. And Ranger Bolton came onto the scene on his horse and scared away the bears and then invited Miguel to come have dinner with him and his wife. And that's where we're going to pick it up at. Anything else you wanted to add before started?
That was a nice summary of what happened last chapter. Right. I almost said episode.
Yeah. As I follow Ranger Bolton to the station, raindrops begin splashing down on and around us, and I'm extra grateful to have a warm and covered place to shelter for the night. I follow him to the horse barn and get off my bike to help him bed down his horse. Having spent summers at my grandmother's ranch, I'm very familiar with horses, and I know just how to help the work get done quickly. The rain has steadied to something less than a downpour, but has the effect of amplifying the smells of the forest. We run into the cabin together, brushing the water from ourselves and onto the wooden floor of the screened porch. He calls to his wife, "Kate, honey, I'm home. I've brought a young guest to dinner." Mrs. Bolton walks gracefully out from the kitchen, wiping her hands on her apron, and steps into a quick embrace with her husband. She is wearing black hiking boots, black ladies' slacks, and a sky blue plaid flannel shirt under her black and white checkered lacy apron. Her bouncy hair curls around her ears and atop her shoulders. The two of them, both in their 40s, it seems to me, make a good-looking couple. "Who do we have here?" she asks him. "This is Miguel. He had a bit of trouble with a family of bears stealing his dinner, so I invited him to spend the night in the bunkhouse." "Bienvenidos, Miguel." Kate looks out the window, hearing the rain falling on the roof. "It's just as well. Tonight is a good night to be indoors, staying warm and dry with a fire and a hot meal." A lively fire crackles in the fireplace, and my mouth waters as I smell the delicious aroma of stewing meat and vegetables, a dish my grandmother had mastered, and that family memory comes floating back. Smiling at my good fortune, I say, "Thank you for inviting me. I'm happy to be here. Dinner smells amazing." Kate smiles, inhales deeply, and wrinkles her nose. "Why don't you two get cleaned up while I get dinner on the table?" She is not quite as tall as John, with brown hair and blue eyes. She moves with the grace of an athlete, and I imagine to myself she's a bit of a tomboy. John chuckles and says, "Come on, Miguel, I'll show you where to wash up." After a quick shower in the bunkhouse to wash off the day's grime, I return to the cabin and we sit down to dinner together. There are substantial bowls of venison stew with dumplings, glasses of sweet tea, and a steaming apple crisp at the far end of the table for dessert. We tell stories over dinner, including a rehash of my experience with the bears and John's heroic intervention. They ask me about my travels, and I tell them the details of the people I've met and the places I've seen. They ask astute questions and express gladness that I enjoyed good fortune along the way. There is much laughter and good-natured teasing. It's like I got my wish and found my Leave It to Beaver life in this moment. Thinking about Wally and the Beave, I look around for signs of children. Knowingly, Kate says, "It's just us." John shakes his head. "It didn't work out that way for us." He reaches out to hold Kate's hand. There is no note of sadness in his voice. They exchange a smile that shows they're content with the decisions they made. We finish dinner, saving the dessert for later. I help clean up and dry the dishes after Kate washes them. John tends to other chores outside now that the rain has quit. When he returns, he stokes the fire in the large stone fireplace. As we sit down in sturdy handmade chairs that surround its warmth, Kate enters the circle of light, balancing three bowls of apple crisp in her hands and arms. We help her by quickly taking two of them and the spoons she offers. I thought we had some ice cream to top it off, but John must have had the last of it. John grins sheepishly. Midnight raid, he says. I had to fortify myself with some nourishment before I... Kate doesn't let him finish. Before you what? Crawl back into bed? We all laugh. Over a little time, the fire and the conversation burn themselves out. John dozes off in his chair as Kate and I stare at the glowing embers. A full belly, the quiet, the warmth, and the goodness of these people reminds me of times with my family in Abiquiu and above the Red River at the family ranch. I think about my father and my mother and the decisions they made to get married, to have children, and to grow a family together. How could they have known a single moment of fate would forever change all their plans? Who of us expects those inflection points in our lives? Before I can answer my own questions, Kate gets up and motions for me to let John be, and whispers, "He'll find his way to bed eventually." She takes the bowls and spoons to the sink in the kitchen, then walks around the cozy living area to turn off the remaining lights. Before heading for the bunkhouse, I thank her for her kindness and hospitality. She accepts the compliment with a knowing nod of her head. Once in bed and still thinking about my family, I fall into a deep sleep. I dream about my dad. We're on the Pecos River fishing up around Cowles. I sit on a rock ledge at the side of the river watching him, up to the thighs in his waders, casting a pair of dry flies at a target on the far side of the river. We both know there's a big rainbow trout waiting there for his offering. The quiet breaks with the sound of a watery explosion as the trout strikes Dad's royal coachman. My father quickly pulls his bamboo fly rod into the air, and it curves into a parabolic arc as he sets the hook. All sound and all motion stop, and I am left with a perfect time-stamped color postcard of the scene, backlit in the warmth of the setting New Mexico sun. I enjoy a good night's sleep in one of the bunks in the house used for trainees and firefighters when they are needed. I wake from a startling dream of bears chasing me through the woods. All right. That is chapter 22 with the Boltons. And some of the themes and emotions experienced in this chapter include a sense of belonging and family, longing for normalcy, wants to be living in Leave It to Beaver land, contentment, the power of storytelling, they bond over storytelling during dinner, nostalgia, Miguel's dream about his father, individual journeys, weather and setting, the rain in the rustic bunkhouse setting can be symbolic and set the mood for the story and contribute to the atmosphere and emotions of the story. So I guess it could be a little stormy as it starts off, and then it gets warm and cozy as you come into the room. And I guess that could be a setting. And then woodsy and rustic, remembering times past when you were fishing with your dad.
So the moment prompted a lot of memories that were based on my experiences in, spending my summers at my grandmother's ranch, which was all about rustic, mm-hmm. right? Outdoors most of the time, bunking with the cowboys, dinners that were made, for a group of men that would eat practically anything at that point in the evening. So it was all about, it was very outdoorsy, right? That's where I learned horsemanship. That's where I learned, like, the small things of being in the outdoors. So, but it was also with the two of them, they were such perfect characters, you know, and complemented each other in the most interesting of ways, which is like, we like this life together. Mm-hmm. Like there was no, I want to be in the big city, you know, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. As I knew them, the experience and the experience that I had with the characters that these were developed from, the McGees, was they were just like that. They both worked for the government, she for the state of New Mexico and the Department of Automated Data Processing. She was a brilliant systems analyst, and he for the National Forest Service. But the minute they got, the minute she got away from DADP in downtown Santa Fe, they were up at their little ranch in the mountains. And it wasn't a big ranch, but they didn't have to because he had the whole Santa Fe National Forest to himself. Anytime he wanted. And he was very much an outdoors person, and so was she. She was I don't want to say a championship quality skier, but she knew her way around a ski basin, you know, and skied some of the better ones, Angel Fire, Taos. You know, Santa Fe is good, but Santa Fe is really, there were a couple of runs in Santa Fe that were difficult, Black Diamond runs, but she could do anything. Anytime she was, I always imagined snowboarding became popular that she would have made a good snowboarder. But at the time, she had to be, when I knew them, she had to be probably, so I was in high school still, and she was in her mid 30s. So, well, that's a 20 year difference. So she would be in her 90s now. But they were just this characteristically storybook couple. They seemed perfect for each other. And I was always surprised that they hadn't had children, because I think they would have produced like the perfect, beautiful, athletic child, whether it was male or female, you know. But I wanted to take their personalities and put them in, add them to these characters in the story. So that they were complementing one another. And that's how it turned out. They would have fit perfectly in that part of the story. Mm-hmm. You know, you couldn't have, the characters, you couldn't have fit anybody better in that part of the story. And it was the sense of belonging. It was like, I'm sitting at a table here, and it was that same memory of sitting. It's a lot different when you're sitting with a bunch of cowboys. Mm-hmm. But sitting with the cowboys, as I sat there, they treated me with respect. They teased me, but they treated me with a reasonable amount of respect because I was doing my job. I mean, I got up with them at 5:30. We had breakfast by 6, and we were on our horses by 6:30. And we were back as about the same time the sun went down. And that's when we'd have dinner. And there was no TV back then, especially up above in the mountains of northern New Mexico, and you entertain yourself by singing. And there was one or two that were musically and instrumentally inclined. So there were guitars and harmonicas and one of those little small accordions, and everybody knew the songs, and they were cowboys.
Concertina,
that's right. And they were cowboy songs. You know, they were songs of the Old West. And that's where I learned a lot of them later on in life, as I'd hear one of those, because I wasn't, first of all, I didn't have that great interest in music, but I especially didn't have an interest in country and Western music. But every once in a while, I'd be doing something and Ghost Riders in the Sky would come on, and I could sing it. Like people would say, like, how did you learn? Where did you learn that? It's from those cowboys, because they'd get together and they sang Ghost Riders in the Sky. And you thought, like, this should be recorded. I was too young and too inexperienced to think about it. But I thought to myself, somebody should get this on something, whatever the technology was back then. I mean, you know, a big tape recorder.
Apparently somebody did.
Yeah. Well, they did. But there was that sense of camaraderie, and the only woman in the place, aside from my grandmother coming to visit, were the housekeepers and the cooks, and they held their own with these guys. You didn't mess with them, you know. But they'd show up, and towards the end of the night, they would drink, but never to the never to being drunk, because if you got loaded the night before, the next day on a horse all day was miserable, you know. So they drink, but they wouldn't drink to the point of getting drunk unless it was Saturday night, and then they went out. They went down to Red River and partied, and got home at an ungodly bad hour, but they were free on Sunday to do what they wanted. So, but I had those memories of those times with them, and spending time with my father always, not always, but when my father got time away from work, he wanted to be outdoors. You know, mm-hmm. He wasn't a let me go mow the lawn kind of guy. He was a get Celso to mow the lawn, you know, mm-hmm. or whatever it was. He wanted to be outdoors somewhere. Mm-hmm. And at that time, I was old enough to kind of participate with him. And I always took it was never an invite. It was never you want to come along. Mm-hmm. It was I'm going fishing. And that was the signal that you better get your stuff ready. You got 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. To get your stuff ready if you want to come along. And that was back in the day where you drove in cars that didn't have seat belts. Seat belt consisted of me standing right here behind his shoulder. And if he came to a stop, his arm went like that. That was, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, but we'd go to Pecos. Or you've been to the places with me that I say I used to fish this area, Dalton Canyon or you know, above Pilar, or those places in the Rio. And that's where he'd go. He'd go to the closest water that he could, fish. You can go to the Rio Grande at Española, but by that time the San Juan has dumped into it. And so it's dirty water. Mm-hmm. It's just muddy. And so it doesn't make for good trout fishing. There's trout fish in there, but they don't see your fly or your bait of any kind. It's got to be above Española. And then above Española, it's all private property until you get to the gorge, you know, the property that's owned by the BLM. So that was the closest place north of us to fish for trout north and west of us. And then we go north and east of us to the Pecos, which is, you know, a little bit, it always felt like it was longer at the Pecos. I don't think it was. I think it's because you have to drive on the road slow, that Pecos, mm-hmm. you know, the road that parallels the river. But any chance he got, that's where he went. Saturdays, he would do stuff that my mother wanted him to do. And then Sundays, if she wanted to go along, it would be in the form of a picnic, like you do the picnic, I'm going fishing. I'll never forget one of the first dates I had with my second wife. She had a friend and her friend's husband, and they said, well, Toby goes out a lot. Where would you go for a picnic? And so I took him up to, you know, the Rio Grande and Pilar, right? Found him a nice grassy spot, and they stood out there. And the first thing I did was put my boots on and walk out in the river. And she was sitting there with her glass of wine, you know, and you could tell there was some disappointment in like, so this is your idea of a picnic?
Of a date? This is not a date.
Yeah, this is not
You're
a date.
You're paying attention to yeah. the fish, not me.
Right. So
I get it.
Yeah. So there was some of that.
But you were doing what you saw your dad do.
It was
but
pretty
they
much.
They were married at that point
were,
in time.
They were married, and there were other kids to be concerned with, you know. And Rita was just my sister was his little queen, so she's not going to have to get dirty with fish. I don't think she ever even touched one, much less caught one. And the two youngest boys were just too young. They were still playing, right? Me, he'd give me a rod and that Zebco reel, and I knew what to do with it. And occasionally I'd catch one, you know, and watch what he did. I didn't get to be as proficient a fly fisherman as he was, because he died before I could spend time with that. I had to learn on my own, kind of. But I always knew what to start with. I was always going to start with a Royal Coachman fly that you can still walk into any store in the Southwest along any river in Colorado, New Mexico, Wyoming, or Montana, and ask for the Royal Coachman, and they'll say, yeah, in the lower left-hand corner there. So.
Yeah. So let's talk more about the sense of belonging. So I put on the thumbnail contentment. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't just the contentment of the Boltons with, you know, their life, and they mm-hmm. enjoyed where they were. They were where they wanted to be. Mm-hmm. But you also felt contentment because you felt belonging, like this was a family moment and that there weren't other kids around to kind of, you know,
take attention away
yeah. or to say to you, you know, you're not with your family, you're right. with my family. So you got to have that moment of contentment, having a nice warm meal, talking with people who were the age of your parents or a little bit younger. Mm-hmm. So maybe a little bit more understanding of, you know, young people, in just having that good meal that reminded you of something your grandmother would have cooked, and feeling clean for the first time in a couple days. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of good feelings there.
Plus a bed in a bunkhouse that you were completely familiar with. And honestly, the bunkhouse they had for their firefighters and trainees were much better. It was a much better bunkhouse than the one we had in Taos. I mean, it was just a ranch that was, you know, dormant in the winter and active in the, you know, long summer that New Mexico experiences. What was interesting about it to me is the conversation never got around to, so what does your mom think about it? Or why are you doing this? Or there was
more understanding.
Yeah, they really seemed to accept the fact that somebody who would want to do this could do this regardless of their age, mm-hmm. and felt safe doing it. They didn't express the concerns that almost everybody else I met, and not that I resented that. I always saw that as an indication of their concern about, you know, this is expressing how I feel about you. How does your mom feel about this? You know, mm-hmm. But they were the ones that we never got there. We had a great dinner. We had great conversation. There was a lot of joke telling. There was a lot of fun poking, and it was topped off by sitting around the fire and eating homemade apple crisp. You know, and then the joke about the ice cream. There was, and we talked pretty well into the night. And if I remember correctly, what happened is John started nodding off because his day started at 4:30, and she got him to bed. I think she put a blanket on him. She put a blanket on him, and he went to sleep in his chair. And she said goodnight to me, mm-hmm. and showed me where the bunk house was, and. So at some time during the night, I'm sure he got up and he went to bed, but she let him fall asleep right there. And she and I talked for, I don't know, half hour, 45 minutes, just continuing on. And I would have spent all night talking to her because she was so genteel, you know, so respectful. Like you'd go like, well, if I didn't have my mom, I'd want this as a mom, you know, because she knows all this cool stuff. She was definitely different from my mother in the sense that my mother was more of a Hispanic, you know, matron. You could tell that in her household, then in my household, especially on my mother's side, it was a matriarchy. They ran everything. The men ran the business, but they ran the household and the lives that went along with it. So, and it was always like that. It was always like that. Mm-hmm.
So we had mentioned earlier in the book, Miguel was like, where's my Leave It to Beaver moment, mm-hmm. and my Leave It to Beaver life? Because here I am at the boarding school, and my brothers and sister are with my mom, and my dad's gone, and I don't get to be at home having dinner with my family every night like I see on TV. Mm-hmm. So why isn't my life like that? Why do I have to live this weird life that's, you know, feels like a half a life? And then now you've gone on your own adventure. You're growing up a little bit and you come across this family and you're like, here's where I belong. Mm-hmm. Here's my Leave It to Beaver family I was looking for.
I could have stopped right there.
Yeah.
You know, I could have just, if there had been any indication of an invitation, they said, well, you know, why don't you just stay here for a while, mm-hmm. you know, stay for a couple of months or that. I could have stayed right there. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd have been happy. I'd have put Uncle Carlos's motorcycle on a train, sent him back to him, and I would have just followed John around for the rest of my life, you know.
That's the temptation of contentment.
Yeah.
Right. And that's kind of like when I came to you, and we had a discussion about why don't we move to South Carolina where your family is. because I could see that every night you get your phone out, you look at all the baby pictures. And anytime one daughter is visiting another daughter, you're all like, oh, they're visiting each other again. Oh, and you have this longing, like, I wish I was there and with them and with those babies. And I was just like, why don't we move there? Mm-hmm. And you're like, oh, but I'm so content in mm-hmm. my little house. And I don't, you know, I never planned to live anywhere else. This is my house. But I'm like, but you're longing for something else. So you have to kind of push yourself out of the contentment in order to continue on with mm-hmm. an adventure. And I think that contentment can be nice. It's a nice break, but it can also, you know, hold you. Like the joke of, you know, that we live in New Mexico, it's called the land of enchantment, but some people call it the land of entrapment, because once you get here, you don't want to leave again, mm-hmm. Because you enjoy the food, you enjoy the weather, you enjoy the people. And then everything is, you know, manana attitude. It's just, it slows down and you get content. So if you had big plans for your life, you know, that kind of goes away because now you're content. So how do you feel about that contentment versus adventure?
So I think I'll take adventure over contentment any day. And even if it's small adventures, the adventures get progressively more contained, right? We're not traveling to Machu Picchu. We're traveling to
the cosmic campground,
right? But as it turns out, I never had that kind of Leave It to Beaver life ever. Mm. Right. Because it went from there to high school, to college, to the military, to marriage, first babies. And then it was babies. And by the time they were grown up, it was something else. You know, I have this memory of the last part of my life that involved having children at home, that involved me traveling a lot, six kids coming home, summers full, springs and falls of just soccer, school years with field hockey and school years. It was there. I was always surprised that we could get together at the same time for dinner. One of those around the table dinners mm-hmm. was rare. And it wasn't because we didn't like each other. It was just because it was a constant motion. Mm-hmm. You know, the Leave It to Beaver family, they could spend 2 hours with him dressed in a suit and her in her flowery apron sitting around the table with serving dishes and things like that. That, you know, and oh, by the way, then we get the odd card, the wild card of 24 foster babies. And that's another one where you're going like, oh, hey, who's which babies? Why is that one a different color? Well, it's a long story, you know. So I never had quite that Leave It to Beaver family just because life changed.
Not you even know? Before your dad passed?
Before my dad passed, you could say that there were breakfasts and dinners like that, where we all gathered around the tables, right? We'd had, because he made breakfast and mother made dinner. And we did gather around the table, but it was less hectic. It was very organized. He came, he left in the morning at a specific time. He arrived home at a specific time. Dinner was within 45 minutes after that. Then it was some TV. We'd watch a couple of the early programs, and then they go into the night with Johnny Carson or something on black and white TV.
Jack Parr.
And he would fall asleep in the chair. She'd go to bed, and he'd go back to bed about an hour later, you know. So it was very much more organized like that. Mm-hmm. The minute I left home, in this case for St. Mike's, it was just never that organized again. So it was that kind of Leave It to Beaver life was very 1950s. Mm-hmm. By the time the 60s got there, it was a little bit more hectic, a little bit more motion, a little bit more a variety of experiences as opposed to, you know, Leave It to Beaver. So
the Leave It to Beaver could have been a nostalgic remember when, and I miss that, mm-hmm. You know, miss that life.
Yeah.
That I had when dad was alive and we would sit down and we'd have meals together. That could be just reliving it here with the Boltons.
Yeah. For that one night. Yeah. I mean, I didn't end up staying. mean, I didn't. My guess is not that John and Catherine would have said, yeah, sure, stick around as long as you want. But as we'll see in the next chapter, I was able to express myself through them, have my own little adventure, and then get back on the road, because the goal here was not to find mommy and daddy. The goal was to get to Mardi Gras. And that's always been one of the one of the motivating elements in my life has always been the achievement of the goal, right? You can always come back if you have to. But my goal wasn't to find my mommy and daddy. I had a mommy, I had a daddy at one time. My goal was to get to Mardi Gras. Mm-hmm. And so as much as I felt that evening about the warmth of it all, I really had to get done. And the next day, as I get busy with helping John, my only concern is, can I get this finished enough time to get back on the road to get to New Orleans in time for Fat Tuesday?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
I think it was a moment of a contentment and the sense of belonging and family that, you know, for a moment you're going like, why can't life always be like this? You know? And the answer is,
it would get boring.
Yeah. Yeah. The answer is you'd be bored in 2 weeks and want to get back on that motorcycle and go do something else.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So.
Cause you're an adventurous type of person. So that kind of leans into the theme of self-discovery and personal growth through adventure. That's how you attained self-discovery and personal growth, was you would have a goal, an adventurous goal, and getting there, that journey to get there, created that growth and self-discovery and
evolution.
Growing up.
So I think that an early lesson was the art of taking a chance, right? Because I think when you take chances, there's no guarantee of success any more than there is a guarantee of failure. There is only the chance. And that's how you have to look at it. There's a chance to learn. This is a chance to grow. This is a chance to evolve. This is a chance to experience something that you might not otherwise experience. So I think the choice at some point was, why not? And that's one of the best lessons I learned in the Army, is that if you want something in the Army or the military, I'm sure that it's like this in the other branches, you volunteer for it, because they don't turn anybody down that volunteers. Oh, so the point that I was trying to make is that once you make a decision in your life to accept that you have choices, and that you generally can make choices that you have no experience or expertise in, and it's going to be okay. That's what I found out. And you'll learn from it, you'll evolve from it, you'll change from it, it'll make you a better person. Anything that I did in my life, I never felt made me a worse person. It always made me a better person. And I'm not just talking about from a interaction, human interaction. I was a better Toby when I finished than when I started.
We talked about the reason you go on an adventure is for self-discovery, personal growth that we find along the way. And contentment can get in the way of that. I'm happy with where I'm sitting and what I'm doing, and I don't want to go on adventures anymore because I've finally gotten to a place where I'm happy. You know, like when you're young and hungry and you're living in a flea-infested apartment, you want to get out of there so you have motivation to go find a way out of it. But when you're comfortable in your home and you've got everything you want and Amazon brings you stuff to the door and, you know, life is easy, you're content. You're like, I don't need to go anywhere else. I've reached nirvana. You know, this is it. So our brains can kind of atrophy. They have found that if you want to keep your brain active, alive, and elastic, you need to have mix things up, right? You need to learn new things, try different things, like the backwards bicycle. Uh-huh. Growing your pathways in your brain by trying new things. And if you stop trying new things because you're content, then, you know, that you get stagnant, right? And you could die sooner. You could get dementia easier, mm-hmm. just different things. But as human beings, we have those things that we want in life, those three things that we talked about. We're avoiding pain and seeking comfort and doing as little effort as possible. And that's the human
being. That's where I am right now.
The human being wants that. But that tends to make us fat and lazy and brain dead. So, you know, we have to fight that, right?
Are you asking me to agree with you on that one?
You don't think we have to fight the contentment in order to have a longer, healthier
life?
So
it sounds funny. What I'm about to say sounds funny to me when I say it. Fight is not the word that I would use. Overcome is the word that I would use. But then the sentence is, you have to overcome contentment in order to grow. Because that's a sentence you're asking me to construct. Right?
Yeah. It's the comfort zone thing.
Yeah. I have to overcome comfort that I'm experiencing right now in order to, in parentheses, open parentheses, experience adventure, close parentheses, to grow, to evolve. Mm-hmm. That's very difficult when you're asking a 75-year-old to do that.
Or anybody.
Who achieved
it. Anybody who's comfortable, they're like, I don't want to leave, you know. Yeah. And then, you know, even if some people are in a bad situation, they're familiar with it. Mm-hmm. It's familiarity. And so they've developed some comfort with it. And to take them out of that situation is uncomfortable. It's scary. It's different. It's change. So we avoid that.
So I guess the obvious question is, at what point are you not going to impose your thoughts about this need for adventure in order to grow on me? And the reason is, we have to think about this, because you're 15 years younger than me. Mm-hmm. At some point, I'm going to have to go like, no, I'm not moving to Vermont, right?
Well, no, we're not moving to Vermont. That's why we compromised and we moved to South Carolina.
We could compromise and stay right here in New Mexico.
Yeah. But then every night you're looking at those babies growing up and how you've missed out on it because you didn't take the opportunity to go see them.
That's a good chance. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. You have to look at your priorities, right?
I don't want Maddie to grow up not being able to hang around with Poppy.
Yeah.
Plus I have so much to share with them.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
We have all kinds of stuff that they're going to learn just by hanging around.
Mm-hmm. Both us and them.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it keeps us young too, because you have to keep up with what they're into.
Whatever they're doing. That's right. Know? And they're busy. I mean, let's face it. They're just
surfing and
they do everything.
Driving their little cars around and keep them real busy playing baseball and soccer.
Soccer, baseball, surfing. What was the other one that they just came up with? Oh, no, I think it was. So apparently Mazzy, not Maslin, Manny likes baseball more than he does soccer, but he's better at soccer than he is baseball. So they got to overcome that.
All right. So I think that's a good place to close it down for the evening. That was chapter 22, The Boltons, from A Gypsy's Kiss, A Treasure Hunt Adventure. And next week we'll find out what happens the next day between Miguel and the Boltons and the little adventure that they have.
Another growing experience when you think about it.
Yeah.
Because this is not that is not something you would have expected to find on this trip. It was like a detour And there are, if you look at the hero's journey as written by those people that write about the hero's journey, Campbell, etc., they always say that the detour will provide additional stuff. And the stuff can be everything from adventure, fear, excitement, you know.
Relationships.
Yeah, relationships, etc. So yeah, it'll be kind of fun.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us today for our story, your story. Hope that you got something out of it and that you want to share your stories with us. Make sure you write to us at stories@hkmedia.studio. There you go. And we'll see you again next time.
Have fun.
Thanks for listening to Our Story, Your Story. We hope you enjoyed hearing our stories and those of our guests. We invite you to share your own stories with us by emailing us at stories@agkmedia.studio. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast so you don't miss any future episodes. Until next time, keep telling your story because your story matters.